In his new book on fasting, Steve Hendricks tells the story about a man named Henry Tanner. This was in the 19th century, and Tanner was what they used to call an eclectic doctor, like an herbalist or a homeopath. Anyway, the dude's life was falling apart.
His wife had just left him. He'd had some business failures, and he was suffering from a series of disorders. One was what he called a gastric fever, which may have been a stomach flu. Another was cardiac rheumatism, which was probably an inflamed heart. And nervous exhaustion, which was just a hair short of a nervous breakdown, probably. So he had nothing left to lose. And there are two stories. One is that he decides he's going to fast to cure himself. The other, he's going to fast and he doesn't care whether he cures himself or not. If he starves himself to death, that's just fine with Henry Tanner. We don't know which is true, but we do know that he did fast. Now, at that time, learned men of science said you could not survive more than 7 to 10 days without food. So a miraculous thing happened to Henry Tanner, who was doing this fast in Minneapolis then, which was that his ailments, far from taking him to the brink of death, began to ease up as the days went on. And by the time he reached about 8 or 9, 10 days, they were all gone. He felt better than he had ever felt before. He decides he's going to break his fast. He calls for a meal to be prepared. And then he decides, while the meal is being prepared, that he wants to continue his fast because his mind has been stimulated with all of these questions. How long can we go? Can we go another 10 days? Can we go 30 days? Can we go the full 40 days that Jesus Christ did? What does this say about human biology, that we can go without food? Does it suggest, for instance, that perhaps maybe we are eating too much food if, when we take the food away, we get healthy? So he decides to pursue these questions. Tanner continues his fast. He ends up fasting for 41 days. During his fast, he resumed his daily walks that he did. And these weren't just little round-the-block walks. These were 5-mile, 10-mile, 15-mile walks, and his strength just seemed to gain as he went along deeper and deeper into this fast. After 41 days, he started to weaken toward the end. He decides it's time to break his fast. And he had fasted under the care of a fellow eclectic doctor who asked his permission to send off an article to a medical journal in Chicago about it. This happened. Both doctors were widely ridiculed, and Tanner wanted to avenge his honor, and for a while was looking around for another opportunity to do a fast. He said, I will fast again, but I will do it in public this time. We can have watchers. And an opportunity arose 3 years later, and he ended up fasting for 40 days on a New York stage. And his first several days, almost nobody came. And those who came would often heckle him. But eventually, little by little, as he approached this supposedly fatal 7 to 10 days, and he did not look like he was going to expire, people became more and more and more fascinated. And the doctors who were watching him, and reporters as well, attested to he was a sincere person. He wasn't trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes, and he was just trying to exhibit what the human body was capable of. And the publicity from this fast captured the imagination. It was in absolutely every single newspaper of any importance in America. It was in newspapers all over the world. And it was from this fast in New York in 1880 that we really date the birth of modern therapeutic fasting and many of the scientific advances that evolved from it. Before Henry Tanner, we had people who had tried to raise fasting into the public consciousness, and they failed. And that did not happen with Tanner. Eventually, you simply could not laugh off what he was doing. You had to admit that the body was capable of surviving for a long period of time without food. And so it really was this dawn of modern fasting. And the era that we're living in, where fasting is so huge today, was a long, slow, but nonetheless direct outgrowth of Henry Tanner's fast.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Steve Hendricks is an independent journalist, and he's been covering this story about fasting for years now. We spoke with him back in 2012 when he had written an article for Harper's that really seems to have helped kickstart this latest wave of enthusiasm for fasting. At this point, it's fair to say Hendricks is a believer. So his book operates on this assumption that fasting works to improve health, that it can lessen or even do away with metabolic disease, type 2 diabetes, some forms of schizophrenia, high blood pressure. I mean, this is a long list. Asthma, psoriasis, lupus, ulcerative colitis, etc., etc. And it's important to say he's restrained in his enthusiasm. He writes about how some of the miracle claims about fasting are just ridiculous and how there is a lot that fasting just, of course, cannot do. But he's confident enough to begin the book with the biggie, the question of whether fasting can cure cancer. Now, by itself, he says, it cannot cure most cancers. But he writes about a woman named Yvonne Vileman. She had stage 3 lymphoma, and fasting, for her, worked.
The reason I led with that is because it's a terminal disease. We have all sorts of, you know, potent stories about fasting being able to reverse high blood pressure, rheumatoid arthritis, type 2 diabetes. That's all extremely important. But the ability to reverse a disease that you have been told will certainly kill you. There is no cure for it. Modern medicine, no alternative medicine has anything that they can do for these people. You're going to die. So I thought that that was an extremely strong story to lead with. Now, what was important about that story was Yvonne Vileman had some very good documentation. What made that a potent tale in my mind was that she had important scans of her body both before and after her fast that showed the recession of the tumors that were in her lymphatic system after the fast. And it was those scans and other documentation and so on that allowed the doctors who oversaw her fast to get her story published in an arm of one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, the British Medical Journal. And then when she stayed free of cancer for years and years, to publish a follow-up that said this isn't just a spontaneous remission, because sometimes follicular lymphoma goes into spontaneous remission where it just goes away for a period of time. And then a couple of years later, at most, it'll come back. Well, 2, 3, 4 years passed. It didn't come back in Yvonne's case. So this was a very well-documented case. However, it also allowed me to talk about the fact that you do have these crazy claims. Fasting is going to, you know, cure all kinds of cancer. We don't know that. In fact, it doesn't seem to be the case. There's some fantastic research on fasting and cancer. Fasting can slow down cancer. It can help with chemotherapy. However, it is not some kind of a cure-all. And I wanted to set both of those ideas up from the very beginning. Fasting can do absolutely amazing, incredible things. However, it is not a cure-all. It is not going to cure every disease that people have. And the claims that you do often hear that fasting will cure this, that, and the other, yeah, some of it's true and some of it's not. And the point I was making was we need to look at these with discernment. My problem with so much of the medical establishment, so many conventional MDs, is they reject the wild claims, as they should, and yet they also reject the valid claims. This case of Yvonne Vileman, as I mentioned in the story, when they were trying to get the British Medical Journal, case studies journal, to publish it, they send these articles out to outside reviewers to say, what do you think? And on one of those articles, one of the reviewers just said, no, absolutely could not have been, this cancer could not have been reversed by fasting. It had to be a spontaneous remission. Didn't offer a reason why. Simply just would not believe that fasting could do it. And so, you know, while fasting's boosters are often guilty of overselling fasting, fasting's critics are guilty of underselling it.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the skepticism that you've had to contend with the book. And it makes me think about the first time we spoke with you for the article you wrote for Harper's. This was back in 2012. It's been 10 years now. You say in the book that you had pitched it to others and that it was rejected. And it's interesting because you say one editor, for example, said your pitch, Steve, your pitch is good. It's well written. The research, the science, it all seems to be in order. But as he said it to you, it just didn't seem right. What did he mean by that, do you think? And what does that tell you about this kind of persistent skepticism to something like fasting?
Yeah. So what he meant, I would assume, was what most people mean when they say similar things about fasting, which is just it is too counterintuitive. So, see, we all know, and this is a theme that runs throughout the history of attempts to elevate therapeutic fasting, medical fasting. You know, we all know that eating is healthy, right? we grow stronger. We have more energy. I mean, all you have to do to see it in your own life is skip a meal and see if you're cranky or not, right? So it's very self-evident to so many people that eating is good. And of course, we all know eating is good, but it doesn't make the inverse untrue. It doesn't mean that not eating is bad. But that is a very, very hard concept for people to grasp. And the reason they can't grasp it, I think, is partly just at some very basic intuitive level from what I was just describing. But a piece of it also is that we really don't have a good understanding. Most of us don't have a very good education about how the body works in relation to nutrition and to self-healing. Everyone will accept that the body, if you nick the skin and you leave it alone and it doesn't get infected, it will heal. You'll get a scar and it will heal. To say that a similar process happens underneath the surface is something that's very difficult for people to grasp. And to grasp it, you just have to know a few basics, but most people don't. And those basics are is that the body is a self-healing machine that is repairing itself all the time. If it didn't, if it wasn't, fixing damaged or miscopied DNA or recycling worn out organelles, you and I wouldn't be here, two or three years from now. But it is doing this. The catch is it is only doing it at a very low rate most of the time. And that's because the body's busy doing all the things that make up our lives, including, above all, digesting our food, processing our nutrients, and putting those nutrients to work in the cells. And the I almost want to call it miracle, but it's not a miracle. It's just what evolution gave us. But I'll say it anyway. The miracle of fasting is that if you give the body a break from all that processing of nutrients and so on, our cells will accelerate those repairs. So those repairs it was doing all the time when you fast, they go up through the roof. And that's how fasting is able to protect us from diseases that we don't have and to reverse some diseases that we do have.
I want to come back to the science here in a moment. A really important part of the story is and a fascinating part, I have to say, is the history of fasting. Let's talk a little bit about that before we jump back into the science. This was interesting. You were really candid in the book about the initial impressions about the deep history of fasting in ancient times that you had written about, where we talked to you, 10 years ago. You said you bought a lot of it. You wallowed in self-righteousness, you say, until you examined some of the claims, and some of them didn't quite add up. Talk a little bit about that, because you're really candid about the fact that it seems like – because it sounded kind of humbling in some ways, and you may have had to not start from scratch but rework some of the history you were thinking.
Yeah. So if you read fasting books, fasting websites, you're inevitably going to come across these quotations and stories from revered authorities. So you will hear that Hippocrates said to eat when you are sick is to feed your sickness, or Plutarch said instead of medicine, fast a day. Or Pythagoras, before he went to study in Egypt, was made to fast 40 days, perhaps grumpily, but he ended up liking it so much that he ended up making all of his students who came to study with him fast for 40 days before they started. It turns out none of these stories are true. They are told in order to reassure the novice faster that, look, this is something that people have been doing forever. That is true. And they knew what they were doing. This is something that they knew how to use for health or to achieve equanimity. Nothing could be further than the truth. And I'm guilty of propagating some of these stories. But yes, you know, when you write a book, you have a chance at least to go back and look in more depth. And I found out, you know, these stories just weren't true. It is true that therapeutic fasting, fasting for health, does date to basically the ancient Greeks, about 400 or 500 years before Christ. But they didn't know what they were doing. And the reason they didn't know what they were doing was because there was a taboo on dissecting the body. So they had no idea what was going on inside of us. So they had to come up with all these cockamamie theories, eventually settling on humoralism, which was this idea that if you balance the body's four humors, these fluids in our bodies, that you would achieve good health. But so you end up with all these crazy recommendations like, oh, if you have hiccups, you should either fast for your hiccups or completely overeat. And you imagine the ancient reader saying, well, thanks, but which the heck should I
which
be doing?
Which is it?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that said, they were using fasting in an attempt, a crude attempt, to try to improve health. And even though they didn't mostly know what they were doing, the fact that they were doing it shows that they realized that there was something there.
Something there.
And every once in a while, someone would stumble on something like this Greek physiologist, Erasistratus, who came up with fasting to cure epilepsy, which was completely forgotten at the time, overlooked. A couple thousand years later, we find out it in fact works. Prolonged fasting works wonders for many childhood epileptics.
Well, let's go further back. Let's talk about what we know, because you say in the book that we know that early humans fasted. But we have almost, this is how you put it, we almost have no direct evidence of it. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, well, you know, archaeology records what we do much better than what we don't do. So, you know, you can tell by, you know, a piece of bark or something between a fossilized teeth. What the people were eating. You can tell from various bones of mammoths or whatever that were in their, you know, kitchens, in effect. And that'll tell you what they ate. But trying to figure out what they didn't eat is very, very difficult. And there's just extremely little evidence to suggest that they fasted. However, we know they had to have fasted. And for two reasons, well, multiple reasons, but probably the two biggest are that we know that it was feast and famine. You know, they would have cycles where the food would be short and they were forced to fast. There's just no doubt about it. We just don't have any evidence to say, you know, in this place during these years, this time of the year, they ran out of food, you know, every winter before the spring came. So we're certain they fasted in February there. We just don't have that level of detail. But the other reason we know that, that they fasted is because, evolution has endowed, the great majority of animal organisms with an ability to survive deprivation of food. This has come down to us from, well, gosh, from yeast, with whom we last shared an ancestor a billion years ago. We know that we had this ability and we didn't lose it. It's not as though somewhere along the way, one of our ancestors, you know, stopped fasting or fasting was no longer useful. So that just, you know, withered on the evolutionary vine. Didn't happen. So so the fact that we continued to possess this ability suggests very strongly that we used it.
Steve Hendricks, his new book is The Oldest Cure in the World, Adventures in the Art and Science of Fasting. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thanks to KUER's mobile app, you can keep NPR Utah as your essential connection wherever you go. Our free mobile app keeps you informed with the latest local stories from KUER News. Explore on-demand podcasts like Radio West, State Street, and Sent Away. Or enjoy nonstop streams of our daily programming, BBC World Service, and classical KUER. Stay connected to your member station with the KUER mobile app, available for free wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history and the science of fasting, which is all the rage right now. But the writer Steve Hendricks describes it in a new book as the oldest cure in the world, though it's not a cure for everything. But it did work for him, helped him treat his own health problems. Hendricks explores the history of fasting and how it works. That is, what happens to a body when someone chooses not to eat. You say in the book that when the first systems of writing emerged, the idea of fasting for health, you know, for therapeutic purposes, that wasn't really mentioned. It was always, at least at first, as a religious practice. Why do you think that is? And do you think that there was some – it seemed to me that there had to have been some sort of connection – maybe not, but depriving yourself of food had to have had some sort of health benefit that they connected with the spiritual practice, but maybe not. I mean, what do you make of that?
Yeah, you would think that it did. I mean, from what we know of the physiology of fasting, it must have improved their health if they were fasting regularly, and many ancient peoples did. So you're right. Fasting appears with our earliest writings, 3,500 years BC. And I think the reason that it is so predominant, because fasting, you know, as soon as writing appears, fasting shows up not long later in the writings that survive. Almost everywhere and almost every culture and certainly every major religion, the only exception is Zoroastrianism in Persia, what's now Iran. But I think the reason that – so first of all, we have to be just a little bit careful. We think of, okay, did they fast for religion or did they fast for health? Well, the ancient mind did not separate those two. Spirit, right. Health, body, that was all just one to them. The duality between, you know, spirit and body, maybe, you know, three parts, mind, spirit, and body didn't come till later. So, you know, if you'd asked them, are you fasting for your health, and they could have gotten that idea through their heads, they probably would have said yes. But I think the reason that it spread so widely were a couple of reasons. One is just purely physiological. When you fast, your blood pressure can drop, almost always drops. Your heart rate will drop. And that physiological state is more conducive to contemplation and meditation, right? And if you fast severely enough, you know, without water, for instance, or long enough, even with water, you can hallucinate. For an ancient mind that saw, you know, portents and the crows flying, that conversed with the gods and the dreams that they had each night, fasting was a portal to the divine. And I think that's why everywhere it spread. Now, it did not spread equally everywhere. So you see a ton of fasting in Hinduism or Jainism in India, in Christianity in the Middle East. But in nearby religions, in Buddhism, for instance, in India, it was only moderate. In Judaism in the Middle East, it was only moderate. And sometimes this was in reaction. Some of these religions, you know, if you read their texts, you can tell they're pretty much saying, well, those crazy Christians or those crazy, you know, Hindus are doing this. That's not what we're doing. And then there are some places like ancient China where in Confucianism and Taoism, fasting was just a very uncommon sort of ceremonial thing is the best we can tell from the texts. So the one sort of common trait that where fasting did take hold that these various religions shared was that it tended to expand. If it got a little toehold or maybe a big toehold, I should say, it expanded. And you can see why, right? If a little fasting is holy, well, heck, a lot of fasting must be a lot holier. So you get these really just particularly in Christianity, for instance, you get this real trend toward asceticism in their fasting. You get these very self-destructive fasts. And it took, you know, centuries and centuries before a backlash to that moderated that ascetic fasting.
Before we leave the religious part of all of this, I wanted to ask a little bit more about how fasting develops in Christianity. You mentioned in the book it didn't start out, you know, with much connection beyond the fact that the early Christians were Jews who did it, like Jesus himself. Jesus probably did some kind of fasting as a Jew. What do you make of the story from the New Testament that Jesus fasted for 40 days in the wilderness? Do you think that was just a literary device? Was it meant to be, you know, taken literally? Was it really about the fast itself or a model for believers? I mean, what do you make of that story and how, even though early on they weren't very enthusiastic about fasting at all, Paul didn't say a word about it, you mentioned, but they eventually – it does, as you say, it does catch hold. What do you make of that particular story though first?
Yeah. So first, I take it as a literary device. It was meant to put him in the realm of Moses and Elijah, who had also fasted for 40 days with the help of God in the Old Testament. So it's, you know, it was the hagiographers who wrote the New Testament. It was their way of saying, look, you know, our guy is something special too. It's no coincidence that they all fasted for 40 days. And the fact that, Jesus practically never mentions fasting in the New Testament, in the Gospels that have come down to us. So we can't imagine that, you know, this was used because he thought fasting was so very important. In fact, there's this one passage where the followers of John the Baptist come to Jesus and say, hey, you aren't making your disciples fast. What's going on? It's not fair. We have to fast. And he says, look, you know, why should we make the followers of the bridegroom fast when the bridegroom is still with us? There will be time when he is no longer with us, and then they can fast. And unfortunately, from that that one passage, a lot of very harsh ascetic fasting grew out of the early Christianity, and there wasn't a lot of scriptural basis for it beyond that.
When does the idea of fasting, not as an act of religious ritual, but as maybe something that could be healthful, that could be therapeutic, when does that first emerge in the human record, as far as we know?
So ever since the ancient Greeks, as we discussed, you know, 400 or 500 years before Christ, the idea was planted, and it would pop itself up. In ancient Rome, for instance, shortly after the time of Christ, there was this movement called the Methodists, and they were called that because they had reduced all of religion, excuse me, all of medicine to a few simple methods. And one of the methods that they had stumbled upon was basically when you get an acute illness like a fever, cold, something like that, you fast for 2 or 3 days. They didn't know what they were doing, but just through trial and error, they must have found that this worked. And it survived for a couple hundred years despite being ruthlessly attacked by people who subscribe to the wackier, kookier humoral doctrines. So unfortunately, Methodism and other things that kept popping up over the years just kept getting squashed by the humoral medicine, which really survived until the dawn of the Age of Reason with the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. So it was really that. It was really the return of reason and the end of the Dark Ages that allowed doctors and lay people to look dispassionately at fasting. And so you start getting these pretty lucid, pretty telling accounts, both from lay people and doctors, starting in about the 16th century, the late 1500s, up through the 18th century, and they just sort of pop up here and there. You know, one in Italy, one in Germany, one in France, and so on. And no one pays any attention to them. They're mostly lost to time. And then it takes until the 19th century, chiefly in America, before fasting really finds its feet, before doctors start writing in medical journals about it, before they start experimenting with fasting, this patient, that patient, the other patient, and then they start writing books about it. But the short answer is really until the last 200 years, every time fasting for health popped up, it got, you know, a little modicum of attention and then just disappeared.
Let's talk about the science, just like physiologically, what's going on when the body, you know, a person fasts. You mentioned in the book that, you know, a very, very long time ago in a revolutionary, you know, past, somewhere back there, way back there, some single cell creature, you say, took the opportunity, when deprived of food, to do a little internal tidying up. I thought that was a nice way of explaining this. Talk a little bit about what's happening.
Yeah, so it's random chance, right? It is simply the way all evolution works. This is not some, you know, strategy that had been thought out by some organism or some cell or whatever. It's just a matter of through random mutation in their DNA when food was deprived of them. You know, they've got this downtime. They're no longer digesting that food. They're no longer processing it and putting it to work. Some little instruction they got from that mutated DNA told them to repair something. We don't know exactly what that was, what was repaired. That's lost to us, and we will probably never know. We do know now that in the human body, for instance, as I alluded to, if you take a break from food for long enough, the cells of your body will fix damaged or miscopied DNA that could turn into disease. Your body will release antioxidants that will neutralize oxidants in your body. Now, these oxidized particles are just the byproducts of all the sort of machinery inside the cell. It throws off waste. And these oxidizing things do the same thing to your cell, in effect, that oxygen does to a spot that's not painted on your car. It rusts it. Well, there are these rust neutralizers that we put out when we fast to take off some of that rust and prevent other rust from forming. There's a process called autophagy, which is a fancy word from the Greek, just meaning eating the self. That's the body's recycling process. And it's a fascinating process. When the body has an old and damaged part that's just beyond repair, it can either just, you know, completely get rid of it, or it could recycle it and turn it into, you know, break down its parts and turn it into stuff that can be used in nice new other parts in other parts of the body. And the cool thing about it is it isolates the part, it builds a vat around it, it pours acid into the vat, dissolves the part into its constituent components, and sends those components off elsewhere. Autophagy does happen in the background in our lives, even when we're eating, but it really goes up through the roof when we fast. So on the cellular level, you find those sorts of things going on. And what that translates into on a whole body level in a human are things like reduced system-wide inflammation, increased insulin sensitivity, which is great because it's the insulin. Insulin is the hormone that moves the glucose, which is our blood sugar. It comes from our food. Glucose is the body's preferred fuel. It's a good thing. However, if our insulin can't move the glucose out of our arteries quickly enough and into our cells where it belongs, we end up with the glucose sitting in the arteries, dinging up the walls. Our arteries become hardened, and we get various diseases. So you see that these cellular level changes are being, you know, made manifest. The effects of them are being made manifest on a larger systemic level, and that is how fasting is able to protect from so many diseases and heal some others.
Is it a matter of the way the body not chooses, but the way the body uses energy? That if the body is, if energy is being used to digest food, which is takes a lot of energy, and there's a whole process there, if it doesn't have – it doesn't have to do that, it can turn to other things. Is it about partitioning energy in some way? Do you know what I mean? Like, okay, well, I don't – there's not really much to do. I can start repairing cells because I don't have to digest. Is it – or am I way oversimplifying it?
No, I think you've got it exactly right. So, you know, imagine two organisms, right, who when they're not eating, basically their cells just kick back, put up their metaphorical feet and relax, right, twiddle their metaphorical thumbs. Well, the other cell got a mutation that allows it to do some repairs or something. It's going to be the stronger, healthier, longer-lived cell. That's the one that is going to survive over time. And I think it's exactly that. Energy is a zero-sum game. We only have so much of it to go around. And the same way that, you know, we all feel that, right? We have a certain amount of energy each day and it sort of runs out. It's exactly the same on the cellular level. Our body has only so many things it can do. And that's part of why it's extremely cautious as well about when to do these repairs. One thing that I haven't mentioned is there's a metabolic cost to your body making the switch from basically digesting and processing and putting nutrients to work mode and this fasting repair and protect mode. Because it's metabolically costly to do that, your body won't do it. It's not like you just, you know, eat your last Whopper or something and 5 minutes later you go into fasting. Because it's costly for the body to switch, your body wants to wait and make sure that you are not going to eat anymore. And the reason it does that is because of, you're right, it doesn't want to needlessly expend energy. And so we can get into how long that waiting is and what that tells us about when we ought to be eating.
Do say, because like I've heard that, again, there's a lot of writing about this sort of thing. I've heard that day three autophagy kicks in. Is it anywhere approaching that number?
Yeah, so you'd be happy to know it kicks in sooner than that. So again, remember, autophagy is happening even, you know, in a fed state, right?
Sure.
But at a very low level. So what we're really asking is, when does it really kick up? And what we have, what scientists have only in just the last 5 years or so discovered. So as I say, you stop eating. There's a metabolic cost. Your body doesn't want to switch to making repairs immediately. It waits 6 hours, is what the research says, before it makes that switch. Even then, its repairs are not in some, you know, completely over-the-top level. It waits another 6 hours, so 12 hours since your last food or your last calories anyway, before it goes into sort of overdrive mode. Now, we don't know, so far as I know, I've not seen any studies that say it's at 12 hours where that autophagy really kicks in. However, somewhere around there in that ballpark is about when the autophagy does kick up. And so, you know, what does this mean in practical terms? Well, studies have shown that most of us are taking something caloric in our mouths 14 or 15 hours a day. So those people, let's say you're eating 15 hours a day, are getting only 9 hours of fast overnight. So that means it takes 6 hours again to get into the repair mode. So they're only in that repair mode for about 3 hours a night, and they are never reaching that overdrive repair mode where autophagy goes through the roof, or starts at least to climb up and go through the roof. This is why you hear so many scientists and doctors coming around to this idea, because the science is very strong here, of saying, look, if you can fast for at least 12 hours every night, you will be healthier. And every hour you add to that 12 hours, your repairs will radically increase, which should translate to greater health. So if you're fasting, let's say 16 hours a night, after 6 hours, you're going into repair mode. 6 more hours, you're getting this hyperdrive repair. You're in that overdrive repair for 4 hours. So that's a huge improvement over what most people are doing. And that's why this 16-8 fasting or 18-6 fasting, where you're, you know, eating for 6 or 8 hours and fasting for the rest of the time, has become so popular and so prominent. I know it's a fad, I know we want to resist fads. In this case, the fad actually seems to be correct.
Steve Hendricks, his new book is The Oldest Cure in the World, Adventures in the Art and Science of Fasting. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Weekends on KUER are filled with the same high-quality news and engaging conversations you hear every weekday. Keep up on the latest news with Weekend Edition and All Things Considered. Indulge your curiosity with Radiolab and Hidden Brain. Or dive into the rich storytelling of Snap Judgment and This American Life. The best in NPR news and entertainment awaits you this weekend on KUER. See what's in store at KUER.org/schedule.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Steve Hendricks. He has a new book about fasting called The Oldest Cure in the World. Let's talk about an important part of the book, and that is your own personal experience with fasting. You mentioned your first interest was in just you, like, I'm guessing, frankly, like probably 99% of people, like, I want to lose some extra weight.
Yeah, in my 20s, like most people, I just, you know, you put on a pound or two a year, and before you know it, you're 10 or 20 pounds overweight, right? So that was my sort of most, you know, upfront motivation. And so I had been looking in my 20s into, well, what way of living has the best odds of increasing longevity? I'd come to calorie restriction, which is just eating fewer calories every day. And in every animal that it's ever been tested in, I think, it absolutely extends lifespan markedly. The problem is it's just hellishly hard to do. You walk around hungry all day if you need 2,000 calories and you're eating 1,500. So I just decided that wasn't the life for me. But as I had done this calorie restriction research, I kept coming across – I use the term research lightly – but I kept coming across because there wasn't a lot out there. I came across all this information about fasting, that fasting had many of those similar benefits to health and longevity. And this was the kicker. This always surprises people. With fasting, eventually, you don't feel any hunger. If you fast long enough, and I'm talking, you know, days, weeks, even months, if you have the fat reserves and are under medical supervision, you break down your fat, and the byproducts of that breakdown include ketones, and those ketone bodies are what your body uses for fuel, mostly during a fast, and ketones suppress your hunger hormones. So I thought, well, this is just a beautiful thing. And so I fasted in this article for Harper's that was sort of centered around a 20-day fast that I did, and that was chiefly to lose weight. I've since come to believe that fasting is a useful tool for weight loss. It's not the whole story. There's so much more going on. But that's the story of how I came to fasting.
Did you make the 20 or you got to 17?
Nope, I believe I made the 20.
Yeah, you made the 20.
Yeah,
that's a lot. Maybe talk a little bit. It's interesting in the book you write about that experience, but you also say you know you could have even gone further. But as you say, you missed just the sensation of eating. You weren't starving, you weren't hungry, but the experience itself, that was interesting. The texture, the flavor, and the fellowship of eating. That's another thing that maybe we should mention. There's a social experience to eating that makes fasting difficult for some people. It's off-putting when someone isn't like, why aren't you having the bread? You know, at the party or whatever it might be. Talk a little bit about the experience that way.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Eating is a sensual experience. It's very exciting if you do a long fast, and most people who do it, I will say again, should probably be doing it under medical supervision. But when you do a long fast and you want to lose weight and the weight is dropping off you at an average of, you know, ballpark of a pound a day, that's extremely sustaining. it will motivate you for a long time. But as you describe, eating is a sensual experience, and I missed that sensuality very much, even though I wasn't hungry. I just wanted, as you said, the textures, the flavors. I wanted the happy surprises you get when you bite into something good. I even missed the crappy experiences where you eat something and it just does. You're expecting it to be good, and it's not. So that was half of it, and the other half of it was I sat down during that fast to dinner with my family, my wife and our son, virtually every night of the fast. There were, you know, days here and there where I was just didn't want to look at them eating, and so I would, you know, stay for 3 minutes and leave. But for the most part, I would stay and I would sit through. So I was sharing dinner with them, and yet I wasn't, and I was really surprised by that. It's sort of like going to school and auditing a class rather than actually taking that class for credit. You're not really a full participant in the way that other people are. Well, I found it disorienting, and I also found it distancing. You know, I still love my wife and son. They still loved me, but somehow I did not feel as close to them. And I was really surprised at that that feeling. But it fully explains why, you know, we call someone a companion, which the word comes from the Latin roots for the words with and bread. You know, a companion is someone you break bread with. So there were some perks, which is if you're not eating and you're not focused on the food, you can focus more on the conversation. That's great. You're less distracted. That's great. But if you're sitting there kind of eventually resentful the whole time that you are not participating fully in this rite, well, that was one of the signs that I knew that it was time to break my fast.
There's one question you say you really wanted to get at in the book, and that is, why is it that it has taken until now for therapeutic fasting to come into its own?
The basic answer is that it is just so terribly counterintuitive that not eating can bring you health. More complicated answer, I think, and this particularly relates to the modern history of this. I begin the book, the quote that's in the front of the book is by the German writer Goethe. And what he says there is, look, even intellectual property in the sciences, even just scientific ideas are regarded as property by the people who advocate for them, who teach them. And if you question one of those received ideas, you will be met with all kinds of scorn, all kinds of resistance. And that's exactly what has happened. You know, the first cure of type 2 diabetes by fasting was by a French-Italian doctor in Paris about 100 years ago. The first cure of childhood epilepsy by fasting, similarly, also 100 years ago, almost simultaneously in America and France. The reaction to this at the time, to both of these, were very interesting. So doctors were surprisingly receptive to each of these things once it was presented to them by someone from the medical establishment who they felt they trusted. And so you found, for instance, in the case of epilepsy, that all sorts of research was being done at very prestigious places like Harvard and the Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins to find out how in the world this mechanism worked, that you were able to reverse intractable epilepsy that had failed in the face of all these other drugs through fasting. This is the way the ketogenic diet was actually born. It was born at the Mayo Clinic in 1921 because they figured out that the body goes into ketosis, the state where you're burning your ketone bodies during a fast, and wow, if we could put people into ketosis by just feeding them a whole bunch of fat, we wouldn't have to fast them. And so that's how that came about. There were similar things going on in the diabetes story. But in both these stories, what happened was, well, eventually insulin was discovered for epilepsy. A new class of anti-seizure medications was also developed. When these things came along, fasting just went out the door. Now, why is that? It's obvious. They threw out fasting because to give someone insulin is quicker and easier. To give someone an anti-epileptic pill is simpler than putting them on a ketogenic diet for 2 years or fasting them for 3 months or, you know, whatever the thing is. It's easier and quicker, and it has a lot of financial motivation behind it. So the pharmaceutical companies who make those medicines benefit, you know, marvelously, obviously, from their use in place of fasting. The doctors also have a financial incentive because the more patients they can turn through the mill, the better off they're going to be. Now, here's the kicker on this. Insulin doesn't cure your diabetes, right? These anti-epileptic medications that people have to take for life, sometimes with awful side effects, it doesn't cure your epilepsy. So that's the most galling part of this story. It's, look, I'm not saying that fasting will cure every diabetic or every epileptic, but it will cure a percentage of them. So wouldn't the most humane thing to do, wouldn't the standard of care eventually be, why don't we try fasting first? See if we can get rid of this disease for good. If we can't, all right, we've got insulin and we've got these, you know, anti-epileptic drugs. That's not what happened. And unfortunately, I think the great resistance that continues on through this day in medical offices across the world is really just that. It is quicker. It is easier. It is much more financially remunerative to give someone a pill or to do a surgery or something like that. You don't make a lot of money saying, hey, why don't you just not eat for 2 weeks and let's see what happens?
I want to ask you finally, how do you recommend people go about fasting? What do you say? Where do you say they start?
So the most important thing that's been coming from recent research, let me go back half a step and say prolonged fasting, you tend to get some real benefits when you get into, you know, 5 days or longer. But if you're not healthy, if you're on medication, you really need to do it under supervision. So for most people, the way to get into fasting in a way that will the most recent science says will really improve your health is this daily fasting, which people know as intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding, and that's just narrowing your window. Now, the science is young. We don't know how narrow a window, an eating window, is healthiest. Most scientists who I've talked to would guess probably about a six-hour window. But as I mentioned earlier, the benefits seem to start anywhere from a 12-hour eating window or less. And the second piece that they tell me is this old – well, it's actually not that old. It just dates to the 1950s. But this adage that you should eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dinner like a pauper is in fact fantastic advice, because the research shows the more of our calories we eat later in the day, certainly eating past mid-afternoon or eating at night, we end up interrupting our repair mechanisms overnight, and we cause more stress in our body because our body is hardwired by our circadian rhythms to digest and process foods far more efficiently in the morning and afternoon. That's what the doctors and scientists tell me in a nutshell anyway.
Steve Hendricks, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Doug. Thank you so much.
That's Steve Hendricks. His new book is The Oldest Cure in the World: Adventures in the Art and Science of Fasting. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Andrew Christiansen. The program produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.